Hey everybody, this is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman. Back to you in the amidst the eclipse, somewhere the sun is not shining, the moon is out. We are in the 173rd Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition Zoom call. We're starting off with 30 people, and we have a great gathering. The second hour, we're going to talk to Norman Solomon and really get into it on the what's going on in the Middle East. I, of course, am of the Frog and Scorpion school of Middle East politics. If you don't know what that is, we can talk about it in the second hour. And in the first hour, we're going to be led off by our poet laureate. Mimi, can we call you the poet laureate of the group Zoom calls?
You can. It's weird, but you can.
What's that?
I said you can, but it's weird, but you can.
No, well, if it's weird, we don't want to do anything weird. Or actually, we don't want to do
No.
anything.
Yeah.
We don't want to do anything that's not weird. So we're going to start with Mimi, and then we're going to be joined. A couple of things to discuss: the issue of abortion in Florida. We have our own Wendy Lederman, who's brave enough to live in a state run by the fascist Ron DeSantis. So we want to talk about the abortion issue. Also tomorrow, I can't curse on the air, but the governor of Missouri has denied clemency to a prisoner there that all the guards in the prison have asked that he not be executed, and the governor just seems to want to kill him. So I want to talk about that a bit. And also, the Washington Post has run a pretty amazing article. I'm sure many of you are banned from the Washington Post by their paywall, but I am able to download it. I use some of our grief funding to get myself the subscription to the Washington Post. A very powerful article about the differing voting requirements in various states. Michigan, where my shirt here, class of 67, U of M, is going to actually have a very progressive pro-democracy protocol for voting this fall, but North Carolina will not, and it's up in the air in Georgia. I just saw a great clip of Larry David. He was standing in a voting line, allegedly, I think it was staged in Georgia, and he handed a woman a bottle of water, and the cops came and dragged him away. I think it was all staged, but it was very well, not funny. So there's a lot to discuss in terms of the differing requirements that we're facing in the fall election. Very interesting article from the Washington Post. Things are all over the map. It looks very ugly in North Carolina, and not so cool in Georgia, but better in many states. So we're going to talk about that as well. So welcome everybody, Carl Grossman. It's great to see you. As I say in the second hour, we're going to get Norman Solomon with us, but now we want to have an invocation from our poet laureate, the Mimi German in Portland, Oregon, who she and I shared the amazing experience of being on the wonderful Peace Boat, the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule was a yacht. It was bought by Quakers in the 1950s, and they fixed it up. And they sailed it into the nuclear test zone in the Pacific. The French were doing tests. And they actually stopped, or at least delayed, a nuclear test in the South Pacific. So Mimi and I were on the boat. It's a tiny little, I mean, it's not tiny, but it's not a big boat. And we were sailing amongst the giant warships in Portland Harbor. What is it, a Fleet Week? Is that what they call it?
Yeah, it's Fleet Week, which we usually are protesting most years. So the big ships are there.
And I don't know how many of you have ever seen an aircraft carrier from below. Mimi and I were on this yacht, and we're looking up at this gargantuan warship. Oh my God, they are so big. And all these guys in their white, civvies there were standing along the deck looking at us. We're waving back. It was really cool. And then Mimi, tell everybody what happened.
Well, it was a like you really have to imagine what this is. The Golden Rule is this, it's a beautiful boat with beautiful sails, you know? And so here's this beautiful vessel amidst these war vessels, and we're just going back and forth down the Willamette River. And all of a sudden, this speedboat is coming, and I'm like, wow, they're going pretty fast. And I said, well, here they come, Harv, you know? And it, I'm like, Harvey, they're coming at us. And we were like, no, they're not coming at us. They're going to turn. And sure enough, they meant to come at us and they hit us. They came right into the golden rule. And Harvey's foot was like this close to getting smashed by the side of this vessel. Anyway, the speedboat was the Clackamas Sheriff's like water police. And we said to them, like, what the hell? You know, like, what are you doing, man? And they wanted to come on board. And so this whole thing ensued, but they hit our boat
They
and
and
they
they put a
meant to
hole in it.
put a hole in the golden rule.
That was truly
And
amazing.
yeah.
And I got to tell you, Mimi looks so meek and mild here, but she was ready. I know we don't believe in the death penalty, but she was really ready to tear these guys' heads off. You were ferocious. We had to hold you back. No, actually, we didn't, but you were
They wanted
phenomenal.
to come on the boat, and I said to them, you know, where's your permit?
Yeah.
And they claimed that they didn't need one. And we were like, yeah, you need a permit. You can't just come on this boat. So anyway, it went on for a while, but they did hit our boat.
They
And
did.
they
And they
did. They a peace boat.
about 3 feet below my foot was a big hole in the in the peace boat. And
And
Mimi wanted to take legal action and
you
sue these
can go.
guys. But you know, there you go. So mild-mannered Mimi is a magnificent poet. She's been on before reading her poetry. And I do you mind, Mimi, if you'd we got 40 people ready to hear a piece of your poetry?
No,
Please.
no. And I wanted to say hi to Dennis and hi to Carl. And it's so great to see Mila. And yeah, so I don't know. Anyway, it's thank you for having me on. It's really nice to be among good people. Change.
Well, you're as good as they get. So let's hear some of your stuff, please.
Okay, so this was this. I was thinking about Hanford yesterday, and I used to go up to Hanford a lot to do radiation readings. They kept saying that they were doing remediation work, and I didn't believe them because, you know, they lie. And so this time I was there all morning doing radiation readings and finding really high levels of radiation on the quote unquote remediated area. And so I wanted to get into the Columbia Generating nuclear power plant area to get to the river so that I could do testing on the soil, but I knew I can't just walk in there. So I stopped at the guard post and they said, do you have an appointment? I said, no, I was kind of hoping that one of you could escort me down to the water so I can take some radiation readings down there. Well, they thought I was a terrorist. And like no lie, they thought I was a terrorist. They all picked up their guns, they aimed them at me, said, get out of the car. They searched my car, they found my Geiger counters, and they kept me there in like right by the guard post with their guns aimed at me. And I decided yesterday, thinking about it, that I would write a poem about it because I hadn't. So it's called Hanford, a Terrorist and a Cherry Blossom Tree. They held me at gunpoint, thinking that I, armed with a Geiger counter, a terrorist. I'm as much a danger to you as a cherry blossom in spring, I told them. Guns pointed at my torso like thorns. Detained for hours, I rooted them to truths from the blossoming tree about genetic changes occurring in their sperm, which would blossom into deformed flowers, resembling their grandchildren in 2 generations. The sun shifted in the sky. They lowered their rifles, aiming now to the earth, asking questions, wanting truth from roots of the cherry blossom tree. You are pawns in this game, I explained. And the terrorist is your boss, infiltrating your bodies with the leftover rot from a century ago. I am not your enemy, said the blossoming tree, but it is you who has been exposed, yet cannot see. Guns withdrawn, they said I was free to go. I told them I have always been free. I am just a blossom on a tree.
Whoa, Mimi, you're too much. That was really beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
I want to note we're joined by the great Tatanka Brekka. Dennis Bernstein is with us. Myra Reason, Dr. Ruth, Ron Leonard. Oh, Paul Guype is here. Hey, Paul, how you doing, bro? Good to see you. So, can you, Mimi, our poet, poet laureate, can you give us another one, and then we're going to move on. But it's always great to hear from you.
Harvey, I'm looking for that letter I sent you yesterday because it had those poems in it. And
Okay, let's see if I can find it.
find it.
Does anybody want to say anything to Mimi? Especially, she was at the Columbia Generating Station, which is the nuclear plant reactor that's on the Hanford Reservation, and which and it has a story of its own. The Columbia Generating Station is the only one of five reactors that they were going to build there that actually got built, and the other four drove the Washington Public Power System, which we call WPS, into a default. It was the biggest public bond default in the history of the United States, and we have done analysis of the CGS there that show it's just completely unjustified economically in any way, shape, or form. It's ridiculous, but they continue to operate it, and then of course, cherry blossoms like Mimi show up and warn them what it's really doing to us. So there you go, Mimi. Did you find? You got another one for us?
No, I'm just going to go cruise into war poems. By the way, when I called Harvey after that happened, like right after that happened, and I told him the story about being detained, and he said to me, you need to stop going up there. The only reason I haven't been up there again is because Harvey said to me, you have had enough exposure to radiation by doing Geiger counter work up there. And so I've never been back, Harv, because you gave a, oh, sorry.
Oh
You gave
yeah,
a warning.
we got to delete that one. But no four letter words
Gone. Are
unless
we
they're really.
deletable?
Yeah, you're deletable. Well, I mean, what you said is
Okay,
you are not
good. Okay.
deletable, but what you said was Dennis Bernstein, great to see you. You got your hand for Mimi. Dennis, let's unmute you. Can we get you unmuted? This game we have to play with Zoom always is annoying. There you
There
go.
we go. I think
You're
you
good.
got okay. Great stuff, Mimi. Nice to see
Hi.
you. And we've had some of the same Hanford experiences. I was around there with the Geiger counter. I was actually pulled up with this scientist right in front of the mouth of the plant
Yep.
to some fishermen who were telling us it was a great place to fish.
Oh, God.
Right at the mouth. This is like, and we got a Geiger counter that's going,
Oh, God.
but
Jeez.
it is an amazing place, and it's amazing that our sort of paths crossed. Did you ever know Norm Buskey? Norm Buskey,
No.
he gathered jelly from across, on the trail that was right next to the plant, and he showed that it was radioactive jelly, and he tried to send it to the governor to talk about.
Oh, I think I heard that story from you. And then there's, I mean, God, we could go on and on about the deer poop, radioactive deer poop and all that. There's just so much. I mean,
Polluted forever, right?
hellhole.
In this desperate place.
Well, I gotta
So
say, Mimi, I'm grateful that you haven't gone back. Dennis, have you gone back up there?
actually, no, I
Good.
have not.
Good. Don't go anywhere
I
near.
got my dose. I got my dose.
You
I
got
met
your
some
dose.
amazing people. And there's this thing called the Death Mile. And I interviewed people all along the Death Mile. And then we saw the aftermath of Oppenheimer.
Yep, exactly. Well, I gotta say, the only time I ever walked away from a civil disobedience arrest, I was sitting in the access road with a couple hundred of my closest friends at Vermont Yankee. And I was actually sitting next to Dave Dellinger. And we talked for like an hour, and he explained to me why he thought that Abbie Hoffman had been murdered. If those of you who don't know who Dave Dellinger is, many people don't. You might want to look at the Chicago 7 dramatization. I think it's on Netflix. where they really misportray him. They show him having a fist fight in the courtroom. It's completely out of character for Dave Dillinger. But anyway, we're sitting there, and nothing's happening. Nothing's happening, and we're expecting to be arrested. And finally, a guy comes out of the plant in like wearing a white coat, and he's got a slide rule and all, gyro gyros kind of guy. And he says, he addresses the crowd. He addresses us, and he says, we respect your protest, and we know what you're trying to do, but you're sitting on an access road. We have another access road, and so you're not really accomplishing anything here. And I got to tell you, something's happening in the plant, and I strongly advise you all to leave. And I just stood right up and walked out of there, man. I mean, that is the only time, that's the only time I've been scared away from a civil disobedience arrest. We all just got up and left. I mean, so don't go. I do not go near
Live to report another day. Live to
I
report another day. Yeah.
exactly right, Dennis. Exactly.
I just posted a photo of I used to do actions blockading the road, the access road into CGS, and I would dress up and call myself God. It was G dot O dot D, which was the goddess of death.
Oh,
And we would block the entrance to CGS until the cops pulled up, and then we would move to the side because we wanted to be there all day and not get busted right away. And it was a federal thing, so we didn't want to get busted anyway because we were going to do time for that. But we used to all blockade up there all the time.
yeah, well, it's time to. I mean, the only reaction, I mean, I would go sit in at a plant or building. And I actually went inside. The only reactor I've ever been inside was at Rancho Seco. They shut Rancho Seco in Sacramento. And Rancho Seco, they shut it in 89. And it's surrounded by solar panels. And the solar panels are still generating power, but the nuke is dead. But I did go in that one after it was shut, but I would never go. Don't and nobody. It's one thing to be brave, but come on, we don't mess with radiation. Donald Smith, did you want to say something? Then Paul
Yeah,
Newman.
I get emails from Jerry Pollitt in Washington State, who's very active about the Hanford cleanup. Are either of you familiar with him, or has he been interviewed
I
here?
know Jerry.
Yeah, I just wanted maybe this group could invite him to speak or something.
Yeah,
Slightly
sure.
private, yeah.
I'd love to know more about that. Yeah,
He's not a fan of women as far as being kind, just letting y'all know, because that's been our experience. So
Okay.
I wasn't aware of that. I didn't
I
know
don't mean
that.
that in a sexual way. I just mean that it's been very contentious being around him. Yeah.
Well, we'll deal with it. Thank you for that, Mimi. I will say one other thing very quickly. I was at a conference in Kiev back when they called it Kiev in 1996, 10 years after the accident at Chernobyl. And I was very uncomfortable. We're 80 kilometers away. I couldn't wait to get out of there. And it turns out my ancestors, my grandparents came from Riga and from Latvia, from Lithuania. And I was going to take the train up there because I wanted to see the countryside. It's a 36-hour train ride. I was really looking forward to it. And I looked at a map and the damn thing went right past Chernobyl. And I said, I'm not going anywhere near that place. And so I flew. And they had a fire that day, and there was radiation in the atmosphere from Chernobyl. And my beloved, dear buddy, Michael Marriott, who was one of the great activists in the anti-nuclear movement, I know Carl knew him very well, insisted on going to Chernobyl. And I said, Michael, what are you doing? And he went there, for God's sakes, to Chernobyl. I would never go anywhere near that place. Well, Kiev was about as close as I got. And Michael later passed away from cancer. I'll never get over that. Never. Paul Newman, Paul.
Yes, I took your recommendation about Netflix and world and the Cold War, and they had a
Yeah.
segment on it about the nuclear about Chernobyl and 10 years after, and they showed the casualties of people, the radiation burns, the people coming down with horrible cancer. I
Horrible.
mean, the consequences are amazing. And then I thought of Diablo, and I thought, this is crazy. What the hell? What's the matter with Gavin Newsom? You know, he should see this, you know.
Certainly.
And also, what was interesting too is how all the Iron Curtain nations after Glasnost, because they said that Gorbachev had to, Russia was going broke. And so they just let the satellite nations handle themselves. And as a result of that, people were able to travel from, you know, different from Romania to Poland and so forth. And then they were able to go from Hungary and cut across the border to Austria to escape, you know, the Iron Curtain, you know. And then I saw all these protesters at Leip, is it Leip? I can't pronounce the name. It's a German name. It was
Leipzig,
a city in
Leipzig.
East Germany.
Yeah, Leipzig.
Leipzig, right,
Right.
Leipzig. And that there were 70,000 people there and they didn't shoot them. You know, they wanted to, or
Right.
some of them did. So this said to me that people can stand up against tyranny and they can protest. But the
Right.
conditions were severe back then. And I'm thinking maybe here it may have to get to that before people wake up.
It took so much courage for the Eastern Europeans to bring down the Soviet Union, but nobody doubts, including Gorbachev is very clear about this, that the fall of the Soviet Union was caused by Chernobyl. I mean, there are a lot of other factors, but ultimately, because the people totally lost faith in the government, and he, you know, good guy that he seems to be in the Western press, also lied about Chernobyl, and but you know, we don't know how much he actually knew. I will say one thing: there were two instances. In the Chernobyl series on HBO, which is devastating, they showed when the ash came up from the accident at Chernobyl, it started coming down in Pripyat and the other areas, and the kids went out and played in the ash because they thought it was some kind of snow, and they all died. And the Soviets knew this was not cool, and they did not tell the children. And it's also in Oppenheimer, because there was ash that came down from the Trinity test in July of 1945, and the kids didn't know, and they played in it, and they all died. So, you know, the legacy is horrifying. We have it here at Santa Susana in LA. There's a site that was completely polluted by Boeing, of all people, and you know, there's a kids camp right up there, and it's just horrifying, horrifying. Well, Mimi, thank you for this. You're just fabulous.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Harv, I don't know if you want me to, you know, read anymore. I have to split by a quarter of. So
Well,
I'm. I...
read us one more if you would, and then we'll get into other issues. But if you can read
Yeah.
us one more
Okay.
immediately.
Cool. So I just had a my third book of poems just came out, and
Yeah.
it's called War Poems, Israel Gaza, the first 100 days of carnage. And I wrote a poem a day from October 7th on, only because I didn't know how to deal with anything that was with everything that was going on over there between the Hamas attack and what was about to happen to Gaza. So it's 100 poems from the first 100 days of just inside my head. And this is every poem is called War Poem Number, whatever the day was. So this is War Poem Number 25. I have burned all the propaganda beneath moons of bloodshed for love.
Wow.
Summer short, summer longer. You know, they're all about pain and love, suffering, not choosing revenge. Yeah, and so on. And I think that probably everyone in this group, I shouldn't say that I don't know, but that many of you probably feel a similar way that when we can choose love, why choose revenge? You know, and that's kind of the basis of this book.
Well, your poetry is fabulous, Mimi. You're fabulous. Ron Leonard, do you want to jump in here for with Mimi? Ron, are you unmuted?
I am unmuted. And thank you, Mimi. That was wonderful. I wanted to follow up just on Diablo a little bit because there is this theme that follows through on all these nuclear reactors. And that is the theme made famous by, I guess, all the president's men. And they are now suing Diablo Canyon to block the $1.1 billion that it has to restart. And Friends of the Earth, which is sort of a organization that I remember from back in the day, took this action in a timely manner so that we have a way of halting foolishness and creating something that would benefit ratepayers rather than something that is detrimental not only to ratepayers now, but to ratepayers 1,000 years from now.
Yes, and many of us were arrested at Diablo Canyon before it opened, thank God, in 84, and that's how long it goes back. And Diablo, this is a very important lawsuit. The Friends of the Earth, and you say back in the day, Ron, it is the day right now.
I
This is
know, but
the day, and so the lawsuit to keep Diablo from getting this $1 billion is a big deal. And the administration is putting aside, we talked about this last week, and we'll talk about it next week, by the way, with Roger Rappaport, is $8 billion to reopen the Palisades nuclear plant. You gotta wonder about the level of insanity that that involves. I mean, $8 billion, you could cover Michigan with windmills and get all the power for nothing. I mean, it's just ridiculous, insane. And I gotta say also, there's a rash of garbage coming out in the media. They've opened the last reactor at Vogtle in Georgia. And you're getting these pieces, oh, is this a rebirth of nuclear power? And blah, blah, blah. They never mention the two reactors next door in South Carolina, VC7. They spent $9 billion on the two reactors at VC Summer in South Carolina, and they never opened. $9 billion. It's much as the Webb telescope, for God's sakes, and they just failed totally and bankrupted Westinghouse. So this lawsuit, thank you for mentioning it, Ron Leonard, is very important about Diablo, and God knows what's going through the brain of Gavin Newsom, but somebody must have slipped in the brown acid. Oh, there's Mimi with Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Can I just say something about that, Harvey? That
Yes,
picture.
please. Yeah.
I put it there not because I was with Helen, but because this was the first and only time that anyone we created a we had a rally and a protest on in Richland, Washington, which is the headquarters right outside this little green area is the headquarters of Energy Northwest and all of the Hanford bosses, the mob, the mob. And we organized from Portland to get people from around the world to come speak and come on buses to protest what was happening at Hanford and at CGS. And Helen came, and oh my God, so there were so many people who came. But the cops, the head of the cops in Washington State, I don't even know what you call the head of the cops, whatever that is, called me and said, "Are you planning on causing a riot?" And I said, "Oh, well, we're not. Are you?"
Oh,
He said he was quiet for a second, and I said, "You don't need to worry about a riot from us, but keep your people in check."
really?
And so that picture is from the first and only protest at Hanford in Richland, Washington.
Well, good for you. That was the perfect response. I'm amazed he called you. That's
Yeah,
wild.
I got calls from, and I got some death threats from up there too. I mean, it's all the stuff that's expected when you do something like that. And,
Well, fantastic. Mimi, you're magnificent. We got to keep having you back. You're our poet laureate.
Harvey, keep sending me the links, okay? Because when I can come in, I'd love to. I want to hear the
Okay.
conversation that.
Well, we put you on the list, and I will not mention that Mimi is a masseuse and treats injuries. And anybody needs work done in Portland, go see her. Okay, Alfred Meyer. Alfred, you got something for Mimi? Let's get you unmuted here. Okay,
I'm
go ahead,
here.
Alfred, please.
I just wanted to say the reason, in my opinion, the reason they're putting all the money into Palisades in Michigan, as to other places, it has nothing to do with climate change and producing electricity. It's all to support the infrastructure needed for nuclear weapons and the nuclear navy.
That's the point of the whole thing. And this whole thing about climate change is just a cover-up sales pitch.
You're absolutely right about that. And nobody said it better than the French Premier, Macron, who said, without nuclear power, there's no nuclear weapons. And without nuclear weapons, there's no nuclear power. I mean, of course, Hanford was originally a giant weapons facility, probably the worst of them. So, very good. Thank you for clarifying that. We know what it's 100% true.
So let
So,
me translate megawatts into dollars. And that figure that you said for $9 billion would translate to somewhere around 10 gigawatts of power from renewable energy. So the foolishness of spending it in a way that is inefficient in producing power is the most costly power you can produce. And then if you wanted to look at it from the ratepayers' perspective, the best thing that we could be doing to help people would be to give them clean, renewable energy, which happens to be installed faster and is cheaper.
and cleaner and safer and more reliable and creates more jobs.
Yeah.
So there you go. And we have, California, we're starting a project now to solarize Los Angeles. Half of LA County, which is 10 million people, about half are in the DWP, which is a municipal utility. And Milo and I talk about this on our radio show on Wednesdays, California Solartopia. We want Los Angeles Solartopia. We want every rooftop in LA covered with solar panels and the sports stadiums. You got Dodger Stadium, you got SoFi, you got the arena downtown, all with huge parking lots. Why are they building solar arrays in the desert or cutting down trees when they should be filling the sports parking lots with all that? So
And
the
that energy is in the load pocket where you need it to prop up the grid, which is perilous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, wonderful. Great to see everybody with us. We got 48 people. Mimi, you're magnificent. You're on the list now. Come back anytime, read us a poem, and
I'm
just
going to hang out till my client comes.
Okay. Well, if you want, we'll run. We can show you working on them. No, we won't do that, but maybe another time.
Client. I don't know. I don't think she'll go for
Okay. All right, so listen, we're going to move on now. It's fabulous to have you and a great discussion. We really appreciate it. I do want to mention that tomorrow, the idiot governor of Missouri wants to execute somebody on death row. I mean, the death penalty is absolutely outrageous, untenable. Send emails or phone calls, call the governor of Missouri, tell him not to do this. It's ridiculous. As I say, I think like 48 guards in the prison actually asked the governor to not execute this guy, and he seems to want to do it anyway. You got to wonder about bloodlust and wonder about our species, for God's sakes. Anyway, I want to move for a minute now to Florida. Wendy Lederman, there are developments with the abortion issue, which are extremely significant. Do you want to talk about that from the belly of the beast there?
Thank you, Harvey. I just want to make sure because I know Paul Burke was supposed to come on at
Yeah,
5:30, so I just
I
want to
don't
make
see
sure.
him. I don't see Paul. Paul,
I
if
think
you're
he.
on, raise your hand.
Yeah, I just want to make sure he's okay to hang out
Okay. Well,
due
go
to
ahead, give
schedule.
us the rundown and we'll track down Paul Burke.
Yeah,
Paul
he's
Burke,
here.
you're on the call.
Here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so just want
You
to
are
make
here.
sure.
Oh, okay, go
There he is.
ahead.
Yeah, I'll go after Paul if that's okay.
Okay, go ahead. Paul Burke.
Thank you. Would
Wendy,
you
do you
like me
want
to introduce him?
Yes, please go ahead and
Okay.
introduce him.
Thank you. I'm really happy to have Paul here. He works with Ray Lutz's group. That's how I know him for a couple of years now, and he's actually one of my favorite people. He's super brilliant and entertaining, and he has this amazing sight. No, he really is. Paul's a special person, and he knows so much about everything voting, and his work is, around protecting elections from being stolen. He works again with Ray Lutz on Audit Engine. So I'll let him talk obviously about the work he's doing, but he has a great site called Vote Well, and it's actually included in the guidebook that Harvey and I created as one of our resources. And that's why we had to get him on. He's the only person here who wasn't on with us yet, but his resource is so fantastic, and it also helps teach people how, like, where to go to get involved with elections and becoming poll workers. And there's just so many ins and outs and tiny, minute details that most people don't appreciate that go into elections. And Paul is the guy that knows, I would say, all of them. So thank you so much, Paul Burke.
Thank you
Paul,
very
that's
much,
it.
Wendy.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. My site is votewell.net, and it covers how we stop election theft. I remember the election theft in Ohio 2004. Anyone know about that?
I was
Florida
there,
2000. Yeah.
unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And since 2018, so current days, there have been elections overturned because of fraud in Connecticut, Louisiana, North Carolina, New Jersey, Texas, that I know of, and maybe elsewhere. We just don't have good defenses still against stuffing ballot boxes, switching ballots in storage, deleting voter registrations, and we don't audit most of the counts. So I have a draft paper laying out 20 types of fraud and mistakes, which are just as bad, and then good defenses for each. And I think that's the key, is to have more defenses and get some defenses against the election theft that goes on. The paper is at votewell.net/ab, as in absentee, ab.html, and I welcome any comments. It covers existing defenses like signature checking and partial audits, and the paper offers other defenses like public tracking of all ballots, better locks, which is kind of basic, but no state certifies locks. They certify all sorts of other aspects of elections. There is an Underwriters Laboratory certificate for locks, and no state requires that the ballots and equipment be locked up with good locks. And the paper offers those kinds of ideas. Electronic copies of the ballots when they first arrive. This is what Ray has been working on, to use those ballot images that are created right away and lock those down to detect any changes later. You can use those electronic copies the way Ray does and a company in Boston, Clear Ballot, does to audit every contest. And then same-day registration is really a powerful way to get around voter suppression. So they drop you from the registration rolls, but if you can register on the day you go in to vote, then it doesn't matter so much. I mean, it's an inconvenience, it's an insult, et cetera, to be dropped, but you can still get your vote in the states that have same-day voter registration. So that's an important defense. So everyone can go observe elections. I do encourage you to go to your county, or if in New England and Michigan and Wisconsin, you go to the town and observe. Because you will learn a lot, you'll meet the people, you'll get a much better understanding of how it works, where the weaknesses are, and you'll build some relationships where you can then work for better defenses. The public knows we need better defenses. Less than half of Democrats trust election outcomes. I mean, we know less than half of Republicans trust them, but less than half of Democrats trust election outlets, and of course, less than half of the non-voters trust the outcomes. I mean, most of us on this call, we vote anyway. I mean, we know there's problems. We vote anyway. Better defenses will get honest people into office based on the votes of the people who vote, and then we'll get more people to vote. Improvements don't happen by themselves. We need to speak up and lobby for them. So again, the paper is at votewell.net/ab.html. The site also has a paper and a YouTube comparing different kinds of election audits. And it has a long list of groups in each state working for better election procedures. So I welcome comments on the paper. I certainly can take some, we see some hands up here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did mention earlier, the Washington Post ran a piece today about the different, requirements or opportunities for voting in different states. And Michigan apparently really, really improved ballot access, whereas it looks bad in North Carolina and still a mixed bag in Georgia and elsewhere. We got 50 people listening to you. Wendy, I'm sure we'll take your paper and put it in the evolving draft of the guidebook that we're working on. It's really a pleasure to have you on. I do want to mention that Paul Guype, it's great to see you. And next week, in the first hour, we're going to talk with Roger Rappaport about the insanity at Palisades Reactor, and wind power. Discussion of that is going to play a big role in our discussion next week in the first hour. So Paul, consider this an invitation to join us. Of course, we have Carl Grossman on and others, Dennis Bernstein, who really know the energy issue. Lynn Feinerman and Steve Caruso, Donald Smith, and Paul Newman. Lynn, go ahead, please, for Paul Burke.
Thank you. Paul, Dominion voting systems, you know, had its little tete-a-tete with Donald Trump. And sometimes I wonder, you know, if they did that just so that everybody else would stay off Dominion voting systems case. Dominion, the name Dominion comes from the fact that this is an evangelical organization, and they are Dominionists as part of the evangelical organization. So I'm wondering if you think their voting systems are dependable, reliable.
I think every voting system can make mistakes and every voting system can be hacked. And the only way for reliability is to check it afterwards. And there are a lot of states audit a few contests, but they don't audit all the contests. Maryland and South Carolina do audit all contests using the ballot images that Wendy has talked about. And that's absolutely important because I don't know the people at Dominion. I thought Dominion was because they're based in Canada, and it was the Dominion of Canada. But live and learn. In any case, any computer anywhere, you know, it can be hacked. And of course, the election offices try to protect them from that. Like I say, good locks would be a step forward. There are a lot of steps forward, and you still need to check it.
Lynn, does that satisfy you? Did you answer your question there, Lynn? You good? Let's move on to Steve Caruso. Steve, in the heart of Ohio here. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you, Paul, for your great work and Harvey's and everybody else that's worked on the election situation since the inauguration of electronic voting. Today in Ohio, article reads that they might not be able to put Joe Biden on the November ballot because, have you seen that?
I did, yes.
Okay. So last time there was an election, 2020, I guess the Republicans were late in getting on the ballot as well because of conventions after the deadline of August 7th, I believe it is, or 9th, something like that. So just a heads up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Last time around, they gave both parties an exemption. I guess if the Republicans don't need an exemption this year, they might not give one to the Democrats. You would think that the Democrats would know what the deadline is in Ohio.
Oh, you're assuming a degree of intelligence that doesn't seem to exist at the party level. Donald Smith, go ahead. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. So I just thought that this issue of not trusting elections, you know, of course, feeds into the Republican narratives. Oh, the 2020 election was stolen. So in anyway, but aside from that, is there any hope of Democrats and Republicans agreeing on election reform that's actually going to be effective and is going to fix the problems, or is it just like impossible to get them to agree on anything because because for example, the Republicans probably don't even want fair elections. So I just wanted you to comment on the prospects of actually getting change.
I think on keeping voters away, the parties are not going to agree. But on counting the votes accurately, I think there's potential. I certainly hear from Republicans that they don't trust the insiders. So the ballots go into storage and who knows what happens to them then. And that was the issue in Ohio in 2004, is were the ballots being changed in storage? So there is certainly room for basic things like better locks. And I think there's room for locking down the images as soon as the ballots are scanned. Because up to the point where the ballots are scanned, they're pretty much watched by multiple people. There, most states, it's bipartisan, but even when it's not bipartisan, it's at least multiple people watching things. And they go through the scanner, then they go into storage, and they're locked up, and the insiders can get in, and I guess heavy-duty criminals can get in, too. I mean, certainly they can. The locks are pickable. So using those ballot images to check, as Maryland and South Carolina are doing, I mean, South Carolina is not a terribly blue state. and they've gone down the same path that Maryland has. So yes, I do see potential for honest counts.
Great. That's good. You have to be careful. You know, we have a very diverse audience here. So when you refer to locks, make sure you're not talking about smoked fish. Okay. Paul Newman.
We should standardize that, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Yes. You should.
Hi, Paul. It's Paul. And anyway, yes. I'm asking, I heard on Tom Hartman today that there's the Republicans in Georgia, and I'm not sure even in Texas, are having meetings about intimidating the voters, number one, and number two, challenging the votes. They can challenge as many votes as they want. Is there anything being done about this?
What I read happened last time is they did a lot of challenges and they overwhelmed the county election staff, which therefore, I mean, either they did a lot of challenges in big counties, which overwhelmed the staff, and then they did a medium number of challenges in small counties, which overwhelmed the very small staffs. So most of the county staffs did nothing with it. And so it, I said earlier that voter suppression, you're not going to get the two parties working together on. And so I don't know that you're going to get anything good through the legislature, but if people are just too busy running the election to handle the challenges, and if they are in fact fake challenges, then that's an okay outcome.
Well, the only thing is they are also challenged. They're trying to intimidate people who are going to vote or vote in line.
And that, right. That's a crime. But the problem with a lot of the election stuff that's crime is that it's a low priority to enforce. I think of it kind of like drunk driving. Even worse was domestic violence. And prosecutors didn't take either of those seriously until the public forced them to.
Wow.
Right. And, you know, the whole dichotomy was very made very clear by Paul Viguerie, and there was another right-wing guy, Richard Viguerie, I think, and where he said, you know, we don't want, it was a Republican, so we don't want big turnouts. The Republicans generally oppose turnouts, and the Democrats support turnouts, and there's a big dichotomy there. Wendy, go ahead, please, Wendy.
Thank you. That really hit me there, Paul. You know, that was that's true. It's so many things that, you know, it's all about enforcement. I wanted to kind of speak to what Donald brought up about you know, just overall there's so much kind of lost in the ether, like lost in the mix of all the things related to election protection, when you have the Republicans and Democrats and these two sides pitted against each other. When, again, like you brought up Ohio, and the first election I ever voted in was the Gore election in Florida. And I will repeat briefly what I spoke about last week, was I remember watching the local counts on the local news, waiting for Miami-Dade. The whole country was waiting on Miami-Dade to find out the counts on who won. And locally, they announced it for Gore. And then a half an hour later, the national news called it for Bush, and Bush's brother was our governor. And that was my first election. And so in Florida, like our Democrats, and like what happened with Tim Canova and Brenda Snipes, who is the head of elections. I mean, I think Ron DeSantis got in because the Democrats allowed it. So when we have a system like what Paul's talking about, where it's you have an independent, third party, nonpartisan, no interest in it, like, the business is to be able to, not saying what Paul is doing is a business, is he's putting public information out there, but say Audit Engine, that's a business that their whole goal is to just find out the truth of this matter. And they're going to take anyone's business, whether it comes from a Republican or it comes from a Democrat. So if we have this tool that is just a way of determining an outcome that has no ulterior motive behind it, I think not only can that quell all the infighting related around election outcomes between the two parties, but also a way to engage the voters that just gave up on the system. And like I say, it's like if your vote didn't count, then they wouldn't try so hard to take it from you. Right. But I think that the implications of what Paul and everybody's work is doing is just really a simplistic tool that can bring everyone together, that create a framework that these issues just become moot. You know, you create a new way until the old way becomes obsolete. Thank you so much. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you. So, thank you. Do you want to respond to that, Paul?
No, no.
Okay, so I want to run by a scenario for you, and you can tell me how credible it is. In 2004, I was teaching history at two colleges in Columbus, Ohio, and my colleague, Bob Fitrakis, was a political scientist. And Bob really knew exactly how the 2004 election was being stolen. And, you know, all the conspiracy stuff that Trump has brought up and blah, 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 which is BS. In reality, we know that the 2004 election was very consciously stolen in Ohio, and that John Kerry was the rightful winner in Ohio in 2004. And if he had fought for it, and won, we wouldn't have had a second Bush term, right? So we advocated at that time, among many other things, the core advocacy we had was that we wanted universal hand-marked, hand-counted paper ballots. And we put that in deep into the mix from there on. And then John Brakey in the mid-2010s introduced the idea of digital scanning. And so to our demand was added that we have hand-counted, hand-marked, hand-counted paper ballots, and that all the ballots be scanned digitally and initially counted on the scanning machines. And then if they were within X percent, if they were too close, then you go back and do the hand counting as a backup. So you kept the digital scan, you kept the ballots themselves, and you had a reliable outcome. And that was our advocacy. And then lo and behold, well, and it did not come to bear a lot in the 2016 election. And I will contend to this day that the 2016 election was stolen in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and that Hillary Clinton, like John Kerry in 2004, did nothing to except blame Jill Stein, which was ridiculous. But when the COVID hit and people could not go in to vote, then well over, my understanding is, well over 80% of the votes cast nationwide in the 2020 election were on paper. And that is really the reason why Joe Biden actually defeated Donald Trump. Because if the votes had been counted on machines the way they were in 20 and cast on machines the way they were in 2004, there's no way we would have had an honest vote count. And so when Donald Trump screams about 2020 being stolen, he actually lost by 7 million votes, which is the third highest total for an incumbent in the United States. Herbert Hoover lost by more, and so did Jimmy Carter. But the reason that we can say with extreme confidence that the 2020 election was not stolen is because the ballots were on paper. Is that a reasonable thing to say?
If you believe, if talking to someone, I mean, it can be reasonable in our group, but talking to someone who believes that the election was stolen, the answers are the reason they doubt, and Democrats doubt, remember, Democrats doubt too, is the paper ballots generally are not looked at. The ballots stay in storage rooms for weeks where they can be changed. Sometimes and they're stored before Election Day, so they're arriving over a period of time and they can be changed. The ability to insert fake absentee ballots is there. I'm proposing various defenses on that, and for the internal processing that there be cameras, that they keep counts publicly. I mean, they do a lot of internal quality control counts. And in an honest place, you've got for each batch of ballots that come in from a drop box or a mailbox or from a precinct, you have the number that arrived, then a few maybe get set aside for signature checking, signature problems, or there's crumpled and they can't go through the scanner. And so you keep track at each stage. If those numbers were all public, there would be a lot more confidence. So if you think of what was happening in Ohio in 2004, or in any of the machine politician, Chicago under the Daleys, people don't trust what's happening inside the election offices. I would say in the last 32 years, since 1992, Democrats have won every election with the possible exception of 2016. Because I agree with you that Ohio, there was a lot of evidence that it was put in the wrong column. And there are a bunch of reporters recounted all of the ballots in Florida and found that if they had, in fact, all been counted, they would have gone for Gore. And then Jill Stein tried to get some recounts in 2016, and the court shut her down. And Hillary Clinton did not participate.
Right. Exactly.
So, I mean, that's a huge, tremendous record of Democrats winning, except when there's election theft. So I don't understand why Democrats are not screaming for better protections at every step of the way.
Because they're Democrats. It's the only explanation.
Well, Democrats always want to do something.
We have
they want to spend money on TV.
Norman Solomon is here.
Yeah, Norman, you're here. Good to see you, bro. Happy to have you with us.
Howdy. Thank you.
I'll introduce Norman in a second. We did have one. We have Paul Stokes had a hand. Paul, can we, out of courtesy, take your hand, and then we'll go to Norman.
Yeah, hi. This is Paul Stokes. And Paul Burke, thank you very much for your laying out all the possible ways that the elections can be falsified and how we need to address that. So I appreciate your covering all that. I had one question, though, that I'm a little puzzled about. That is the concern about the ballots that are in storage. Let me just state the reason. By the time they go into storage, the ballots have already been counted. They've been counted by electronic means, and then the ballots have to be stored away. So the ballots that are in storage wouldn't affect the initial accounts. The only thing I could imagine to be concerned about would be the post-election audits, where we use those paper ballots, and it would tend to falsify that. But that sounds like a very difficult thing to do in a constructive way. I could be wrong about that, and maybe that's the issue. But it doesn't seem to me that's a big problem. So please tell me why I'm wrong.
Yeah, that is the issue. In Cleveland, people were arrested for changing the ballots in storage. Insiders were arrested and got some very short prison terms. You're absolutely right that the numbers are counted before the ballots go into storage, and the images are made, and those images can be kept safe. Remember, the first question that came on this afternoon was, do we trust Dominion voting equipment? And my answer was, it's computers, and the programmers can make mistakes, and people can hack them. So you do need to check. You can't just depend on the counts, the first counts from the election machines. That's the problem. If you save the images well, with a digital signature, and you make sure that digital signature is widely spread out, so you can tell if the you make several copies of the images, store them separately so they don't all disappear at the same time, and save the digital signatures so you can check that those copies are still legit, then those are more useful than the paper for checking later.
Right.
Otherwise, if you don't have those, then you have to keep the paper somehow really, really well.
Well, this is all extremely relevant to the upcoming election. We know how to do a reliable election.
Yeah.
It's hand-marked paper ballots coming in and out by mail or however, digitally scanned and then reliably stored. And so the hand counting can go on as a backup if there's a serious question about the digital scanning. But after all these years, where we don't know how to operate a safe nuclear plant, we do know how to operate a safe, reliable election. And Paul, thank you so much for that. Paul, put your contacts in the chat, please, and join us in the production of this handbook that we want to do for safe grassroots elections. Ruth Strauss, I know you have your hand up. If you can wait, please, for Norman's been waiting. We told him he'd be on it at 3. Let's get going. And we will definitely call on you in a bit, Dr. Ruth. Thank you for raising your hand. Thank you for being with us. We have 52 people, the great Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is a great hero in the history of nuclear safety, nuclear power opposition, health and radiation issues, and now for a long time on the question of war. Norman, great to have you. You were my co-author on Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation, which we will talk about, and which is available free online. Unfortunately, or actually fortunately, in a good way, our co-author, Robert Alvarez, who was really the great guru of the radiation and health issue, is having dinner as we speak with his daughter and grandchildren. That's the one excuse I will always accept. So there you go. And speaking of that, by the way, 2 weeks from tonight is the first Seder of Passover. So we will not be meeting 2 weeks from tonight. We will meet next week. We'll have Roger Rappaport talking about energy, and then a very special hour on electronic radiation in the atmosphere. Norman, welcome. 52 people with you. We're glad to have you with us.
Hey, thanks, Harvey. And in 2 weeks, I hope that at the Seder's, people will have a special liturgy, Let My Palestinian People Go, as the slaughter continues in Gaza, subsidized by the U.S. government. People may not be aware on this Zoom call that back in the 1970s, Harvey was a pioneer, not only analyzing what was and is wrong with nuclear power, but also the potential for nonviolent civil disobedience. And going back from then to today, that is such a powerful, somewhat utilized, but largely untapped grassroots capacity. So, hey, you know, history goes on. And obviously, as always, we have a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. And Norman, you and I hooked up back in the day when Carl Grossman was fighting Shoreham. And so many, and Paul Geip was pioneering wind energy, you know, Tatanka was working with Bricka was working with Cesar Chavez, and Greg Coleridge is with us as a pioneer in fighting the money and politics and that the horrible Supreme Court decision. And Ron Lehner, a pioneer also in renewables. We really have an amazing a group of people with us. And what happened to bring you and I together, Norman, and I'll tell the story very quickly if I can, is that we did these concerts in New York City, the Muse concerts with Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, Graham Nash, Bruce Springsteen, the magnificent crew, the Musicians United for Safe Energy. And immediately after the concerts, which were in September of 79, I started getting phone calls from central Pennsylvania. This was 6 months after the accident at Three Mile Island. And mostly women were calling me and telling me that whereas the industry was saying no one had been harmed at Three Mile Island, people, in fact, were dropping dead and their hair was falling out and they had sores and lesions and cancers and all this horrible stuff was happening. And they really dragged me into central Pennsylvania. I went there in January of 1980, and it was the worst week of my life, literally. I was going from house to house, talking about being in a radiation zone, and talking to people, and they're showing me their scars, and they're horrible. And not only the people, but the animals were dropping dead. I stood across the river from Three Mile Island, looking at Three Mile Island in Middletown, and I was handed a small black Cocker Spaniel that had been born with no eyes. I mean, God, I thought I was in the middle of Godzilla versus King Kong. So I wrote it up. I was on assignment from Rolling Stone. I wrote it up and I said, look, all these people are dying. And Rolling Stone wouldn't print it. They said I didn't have sufficient evidence. I mean, this is a time when the nuclear industry was just, you know, attacking anybody who said, A, that nuclear plants could blow up. They said that was not possible. We learned slightly different at Fukushima. And B, that not enough radiation came out of Three Mile Island to harm anybody. But we knew that they didn't know how much radiation came out, and we knew didn't know where it was going. So I did get an op-ed published in the New York Times on March 28th, 1980. And they would not allow me to say that even as an editorialist, I believed that people were harmed. All they would let me say, and Norman is very familiar with this game, they would only let me say that the farmers in the area thought people were being harmed. They wouldn't let me, the writers, say. So I figured the only way we could ever prove what happened at Three Mile Island was to find out what happened elsewhere where there was radiation. We went to Norman and I connected. And Norman, you wrote a magnificent chapter on what happened to the atomic veterans. Can you tell us about that and what was involved? And by the way, you can get Killing Our Own free online. Somebody copied it. And if you go to Radical or something like that, just Google Killing Our Own and you can get a free copy online. And Norman, you were absolutely essential. So tell us what you learned about the atomic vets.
Well, you know, Harvey, what you recounted here about what you discovered in Harrisburg area, Three Mile Island neighborhoods, really resonated for me in terms of going to Southern Utah, because after we got the book contract and I was working on the nuclear weapons part of Killing Our Own, I went to Southern Utah, I went to Nevada, talked to people from Northern Arizona, and it was very similar going house to house. And for so many years, and we tend to forget that there were atmospheric above ground nuclear bomb explosions in Nevada from 1951 up till the Limited Test Ban Treaty in the early 60s. And the government, as is its proclivity, lied constantly, telling people downwind there is no danger. And the leukemia and the cancer began to happen within a few years. By the late 50s, it was pretty clear. And so, long story short, and as you mentioned, Harvey, with the tremendous help from Bob Alvarez, who's just a path-breaking person in terms of research on ionizing radiation in the nuclear industry, we did come out with the Killer Own book in 1982. And of course, the long-term point is that the research, the writing, the speaking, the interviews were part of building movements, building anti-nuclear movements. And it only dawned on me through working on the book that the connection, we used to say power and weapons, nuclear Siamese twins, they're so integrated and intertwined. This is a death industry. This is a death entire economy. We live in a political economy of death. Now, most of the budget of the federal government, the discretionary budget, goes to the military. We have a bipartisan military machine. I just wrote a book that came out that will be in paperback in September with a big Gaza war section called War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. These are the hidden tolls. And meanwhile, as Martin Luther King Jr. talked about when he denounced what he called the madness of militarism, wherever you live in the United States, you don't have to go far. Lack of health care, education, housing, neonatal care, elderly care, on and on. So, you know, it's back to the future, the more things change. But in retrospect, and I was thinking about this this morning, contemplating our conversation this afternoon, when Killing Our Own came out, and I was involved with the Citizens Hearings for Radiation Victims in 1980, so we're talking early 1980s, if my math is right, we're talking half the nuclear age has transpired since then. And the situation, as we would have extrapolated, has gotten worse and worse.
It is amazing. And I also want to acknowledge another hero, Dennis Bernstein, who's with us. He's the co-host of the Great Flashpoints show on KPFA, which is syndicated nationwide. I don't know, Dennis, if you have had Norman on your show. We probably have, but
sure. Many times, and you go back to WBAI in the 1980s, the program First Contragate, and Dennis anchored just a tremendous show exposing the lies, deceptions, and omissions of outlets like the New York Times and Washington Post. And it is, again, back to the future when I'm on the Flashpoint show. We're talking about the latest depredations, the cover-ups, the distortions from the New York Times. That was the case in the 1980s when we were on the radio then.
Yes, it was. I got to say, after the Times published my op-ed, the Times itself, the editorial board, I got on the op-ed was printed because there was a woman named Charlotte Curtis, who was very, very smart and very brave. She's actually from Columbus. Printed the piece after we had many, many discussions about it. And then it was attacked by the rest of the editorial board on the New York Times. It was one of the only times in history where the New York Times editorial board denounced an op-ed that had run on the New York Times editorial
board. And Harvey, let's not forget Jane Brody.
Yes. Oh, my God. God, there was so much that happened. And Norman, you were such a pioneer with this. I will say that because of Killing Our Own, it was published by a big house. It's amazing they published it. Del Delta published it. It's a big book. And it didn't sell huge numbers, but it went to the right people. And the publicity department got me on. I love to tell this story. They got me on the Today Show with Bryant Gumbel, who was basically a sports guy. And so I'm sitting there with Bryant Gumbel right up to the last minute when they turned on the cameras. We were talking about college basketball. And so they come on. And I just matter-of-factly say that people were killed by Three Mile Island. And he, you know, it just was another thing his guest was saying. The next day, the nuclear industry sent a two-page telegram to the president of NBC News demanding a retraction, or at least equal time. And so they had a guy on to refute us. And he was lame. And Chris Wallace interviewed him and said, well, I guess we'll just have to have these guys back on to debate you. So I got back on with this guy. I don't think Brian Gumbel was the MC at the time. And we had a big go around. And when I again claimed that said the factual that Three Mile Island was killed people. And as soon as the cameras went off, this guy picked up our book and threw it at me.
He threw the book at you, Harvey.
There you go. So that's why I have a dent in my head. Ruth Strauss, join us with Norman Somm. We got 55 people, and it's great to have a hero, so many heroes on with us. Go ahead, Ruth. Are you unmuted? Got to unmute you there.
Yeah, I tried. Tatanka, I hate to interrupt the flow here, but Tatanka keeps texting me thinking it's going out to everyone. So if Tatanka, you could stop texting me, I'd appreciate it. Select the down arrow and hit everyone.
Oh, yeah, you got to text the everybody. Tatanka, text everybody. Let's try Ruth again. Ruth, can we get you unmuted?
Yeah, we're trying to unmute her. I don't know if okay. She walked away.
Norman, I want to mention one thing. Later. We are developing a guidebook, a people's guide to election, grassroots election organizing. And Wendy Letterman is the primary editor, and we would like to send you a copy so that Roots Action could take a look at it. We're trying to, you know, the more the merrier. We want to, our focus has been on both stopping nuclear power and on grassroots election procedures. And Roots Action would be a great partner to join with us on this. And Wendy's been doing the basic work. So we will send you a PDF if you're game.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of grassroots organizing, I do want to mention there's one particular upcoming nationwide week of events I want to call everybody's attention to. It's important politically. I think many of you would find it important personally. And that's Daniel Ellsberg Week. As we know, Daniel Ellsberg Presente, he passed away last June. And so during the week that will encompass the first anniversary of his death, Roots Action is working with many other groups to organize a lot of activities around the country for Daniel Ellsberg Week. And why is this important? You can think of the reasons. If you've read his book, The Doomsday Machine, of course, you know about what Dan Ellsberg did for more than 50 years after releasing the Pentagon Papers and risking the rest of his life in prison. He was an anti-war activist. He was a social justice activist. And most of all, he had a passion for doing everything he could to prevent nuclear war. About 5 years ago, I worked with a team from the Institute for Public Accuracy and Roots Action, and we were able to get 535 copies of the paperback of the book, The Doomsday Machine. And we took a copy to every single Senate and House office in Washington, D.C., with personal letters from Dan. It wasn't just a form letter. It was, Dear Congressperson Smith, Dear Congressperson Jones, this is a book that I really hope you will read. The single most important thing that we can do to reduce the chances of nuclear war is to shut down all ICBMs, get rid of all land-based nuclear missiles. And the book, as you know, if you've looked at it, it explains clearly why all these ICBMs should be unilaterally shut down. And when people say, oh, no, you can't do it unilaterally, it's like saying we're all standing in a vat of gasoline, the Russians, the Americans, and we're both lighting matches, so you shouldn't stop lighting matches because it's unilateral. It's a craziness of the nuclear madness. So long story short, when we took the book around many times, and I had this experience frequently, I would take the book and the letter, and I would go to the front desk and talk to the employee of the member of the Congress, Senate or House. I would say, Daniel Ellsberg has a letter and a book for the congressman or the congresswoman. And guess what the answer often was?
Who is he?
I'm not familiar with that name, Daniel Ellsberg. Can you imagine? These are people working in the Capitol for members of Congress. That underscores the value of Daniel Ellsberg Week. We have an entire menu of things people can do, and it is June 10th to 16th, so there's time to gear up for it. We got a boilerplate template resolutions that can be taken to city councils, county commissions, state legislatures. Declare Daniel Ellsberg Week in this city, this town, this state. And also we have ways that people can go to their local authorities, quote unquote, whoever they are, and say, we want a street, an avenue, a highway named after Daniel Ellsberg. We want a high school, an elementary school named Daniel Ellsberg High School. We want libraries named after Daniel. His name is a first step to reversing this amnesia, the United States of amnesia, as it's been called, this way of trying to put Daniel Ellsberg and his message down the Orwellian memory hole. So to just sort of sum up, to get information, you can contact me for how to do this, just norman@rootsaction.org, or go to our website. We built this coalition called Defuse Nuclear War, and you can click there and you'll find out, defusenuclearwar.org.
Fantastic, Norman. You do such great work. Thank you for your kind words about me earlier. I never had much choice about being anti-nuclear. I was living on a hippie farm where we're trying to be, look at that. Yeah, and we were trying to be organic, and they came in trying to build a nuclear plant 4 miles from our house. I mean, what are you going to do? But we did stop them. And you've had an incredible career. I want to ask you about that. But first, let's go to Tatanka Bricka. I don't know if you two guys know each other, but Tatanka is himself a great organizer, currently the chair of the KPFK board here in L.A., long history with Danny Sheehan and Cesar Chavez and so many people. Tatanka, go ahead, please.
Norman, thank you for your lifelong work. I'm a great follower of your everything you write. And thank you for doing the work on Daniel. I have a suggestion for our program here that maybe, Harvey, we could have anybody that's willing anywhere in the nation to call in while we're doing this program during that week and report what you're doing. We need to have ways in the media to create a movement around this, because this is what Daniel always wanted. I was really privileged to, you know, be a friend of Daniel and Patricia, and have spent time in the Pacific Ocean in their place, you know, at Stinson. And Daniel spoke with his little baby Michael in my arms at the wedding of my last wife out at Pete Douglas's beach house at Miramar, and many, many incredible memories. And he is his spirit lives on. This man, along with David Harris, are two of the brightest spirits that still speak to me. I mean, I still have access to their, you know, that's possible with people that live with such passion and such clarity. I do want to say, and thank you for focusing on stopping that, you know, the ground-based missiles and shutting them down for the ICBMs. I want to bring to attention, and I hope in a future show we can arrange Danny Sheehan to show up. He has been very quietly the constitutional attorney for people in the Air Force and the Navy who have been punished or silenced or worse for reporting their observations of UFOs and ETs. And it's a long story, but he is now has an office right in D.C. at the Methodist Building between the Supreme Court and the Senate office buildings. And he is very active with a piece of legislation that passed universally in without one single dissent in the Senate, a bill that was championed by Schumer and would have passed the House with only a handful of MAGA Republicans, but they held it up and took the teeth out of the bill. But the bill is for disclosure by the Pentagon on everything that has gone on, at least since January of 1945, with UFO craft and with ET. Why is this important for us? Well, there are many things that need to be vetted out into the House. This bill creates, and there is going to be a disclosure project that takes stuff from the Pentagon to the Library of Congress through the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee, and to get it out to the people. The parts that were gutted by two people, MAGA Republicans representing districts of aerospace, were to get subpoena power to get this out when they don't, and to get it into a civilian board in the Congress so we can vet the information, because we can't believe it without vetting it. There are reports that one of the long-term programs in there is to develop a vehicle that can deliver a multi-nuclear warhead to anywhere on Earth within 90 to 120 seconds, which would be no warning, would destabilize the entire understandings we have now. There's also many, many other issues. How much...
Tatanka, excuse me just for a second. We do have Dr. Ruth back.
Oh, okay. Okay, go ahead, Tatanka. And Norman, if you'll respond, I assume that this is something you're working on.
Well, very briefly, what's unique about ICBMs is they're on hair trigger alert. And Dan was very explicit about this in his book and his speaking for his last years, that in contrast to the sea-based or the air-based nuclear weapons, that there's no warning time, really. And uniquely, it's these land-based nuclear weapons that give a president just a few minutes, literally, to decide whether there should be a U.S. nuclear attack on another country, probably Russia. And the net effect of that is that these weapons are on launch on warning. They are on hair trigger. And is it a flock of geese? Is it incoming nuclear weapons from Russia? That's why, and of course, ICBMs are so lucrative from Northrop Grumman and so forth, but that's why it's so crucial to shut them down.
Yes, and we have had many, as you know, human angels that have prevented such a nuclear war. Right. And there are many reports of ETs disabling nuclear submarines and other incidents that have actually prevented a nuclear war. The other issue, and then I'll stop now on this, is to determine how much the reverse engineering has there been. There are some reports that we may have had free energy for the whole world from this technology since the Eisenhower days, that we've never needed the oil war. That's a secret that it's being militarized, and there are all kinds of reports. I used to live in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and anybody who lives in Ben Lomond or Bonnie Doon, you can go to Neighbors, and they've seen craft come out of the Lockheed Air Force Base. They're not extraterrestrial. They're Lockheed facilities, and they're Raytheon machines. There's all kinds of machines doing all kinds of things at high speeds. They can't materialize and dematerialize, but there's a lot of reports of involvement in other countries that the other countries end up fighting among each other, and it isn't any of them. It's this work coming out of our U.S. National Security community.
Thank you, Tatanka. Fabulous. Much appreciated. I know you. One thing that's really moved me, parallel with your career in stopping nuclear war, is this movie, The Man Who Saved the World. I'm sure you're familiar with it. The guy's name was Stanislav Petrov, and you mentioned a flock of geese. He was at a station in Russia, which was to launch missiles against the United States if they perceived an attack. And as I'm sure you're aware, there was a perception of an attack. And this guy, all by himself, stood up to the whole Soviet apparatus and refused to launch. And that was right before, as it turns out, the national showing of the movie The Day After, which apparently was seen by Ronald Reagan. If you've seen the series on Netflix about the Cold War, for some reason, here we go. Reagan apparently saw that movie The Day After, and it apparently affected him. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, the story is that Reagan saw it twice, and as you say, was deeply affected by it. And of course, that was in tandem with the tremendous organizing that people had been doing for many years. In 82, a million people in Central Park at the anti-nuclear rally. So, you know, like our much missed and always beloved leader of Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter, used to say, The spreadsheets never make it into the history books. And yet, to get history to change, we need our spreadsheets. We got it organized.
Absolutely. And I'll never forget the story Helen Caldicott told. Helen Caldicott, you know, I'm sure you know very well, met Reagan's daughter at the Playboy Mansion. Where else would Helen Caldicott meet Reagan's daughter? And Patty Reagan, or Davis, I guess, set up the meeting for Helen to talk to Reagan. And she talked to Reagan, according to her, for 90 minutes and came out terrified. But somewhere along the way, you know, Reagan softened and was able to talk to Gorbachev. And, you know, I often say, and I'd love to hear your take on this, that one of our greatest presidents was actually Nancy Reagan. You know, he had Alzheimer's. He was out of it by 85, 86. And she is the one who really reached out to Gorbachev. Do you agree with that analysis? Yeah,
it does seem credible. And this is one of the silver linings in the very murderous dark cloud of 8 years of the Reagan administration, that right. He did see the light and really chilled out from the beginning, being a cold warrior, to really moving towards detente. And it's really notable where this has gone in the last few years. It's really gone down the tubes, where after 2016, when Trump became designated to be president, let's put it that way, the Democrats immediately needed to figure out who to blame. They couldn't blame Hillary Clinton for taking six-figure checks for a single speech to Wall Street corporations. They blamed the Russians. And there's a book called Shattered that was written by a couple of reporters, including one from The Hill, that documents that 24 hours after the 2016 election, the headquarters in Brooklyn, I think it was, had a meeting, and they decided they were going to blame the loss on Russia. So there was all this Russiagate scheme. And from there, we've had this legacy now of enormous hostility towards Russia and the gear up of a new Cold War, which is, to put it mildly, extremely dangerous. But the military-industrial complex is doing great. They're selling tremendous quantities of weapons to Ukraine, and often basically being subsidized by the U.S. Treasury. And now they're also licking their chops at this $14 billion that already got through the Senate and now is possibly going to get through the House for more weapons for Israel. So, you know, the Raytheons, the Northrop Grummans, the Boeings, they never lose a war. They always come up on top. It's just human beings who lose.
You've had such an amazing career. Let's see if we can get Ruth Strauss unmuted. And then Stephen, and then we'll... There you go. Ruth, can you talk now?
Yeah, sure. First, quickly, Tatanka, I want you to know that I go back with Danny to Father Bill when, you know, mammoths roamed the earth. So... I think he's, you know, just wonderful, and he's devoted his life to all the good causes. So I heartily recommend his being on. The second thing is, I want to commend Harvey and Norman, not only for their knowledge, but for their bravery. And you only have to know about Silkwood or recently John Barnett of Boeing to know that these guys don't play. So when you do stuff like that, you're being brave, whether you know it or not. So, you know, I know it. I hope you do. What I wanted to say is that the first guest, I'm not sure how you can alter paper ballots. Maybe you can, but and that would be interesting to know. But what I do know is that Dean Logan spent $300 million on our voting machines. And thanks to somebody, I forget her last name, Denise, who is a voting activist, got a hold of the Freeman report, which was a technical report on these machines. And there were 47 flaws, 43 flaws, seven of which were fatal, such as being able to open the back of the machine, take a bunch of ballots out, stick a bunch of ballots in, thumb drives, you know, no record of when the machines were open or not open. So I just wanted to say that we have a real job to do, and that is getting people not to use those machines. and people are mailed ballots. But when I voted recently, I saw people go, you know, I dropped my ballot off and I saw, you know, the machine set up and people voting at them. So anyway, that's it. Thank you. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you. Norman, I know you've worked mostly on weapons issues. Roots Action. Can you tell us a bit about Roots Action and what you guys do?
Wonderful.
You're aligned with Jeff Cohen, an old friend of mine, and David Swanson. You got a really all-star crew there. So what? Tell us about Roots Action.
Well, back in 2011, a bunch of us were talking about a phenomenon that was really troubling. We felt that at that point, the big donkey in the online room for progressives was Move On. And we really saw that Move On, when there was a Republican in the White House, was more anti-war. And then when there's a Democrat in the White House, not such a problem. And more we saw that there was a sort of a progressive online establishment, so to speak, that was way too close to the Democratic Party. And we wanted a online action arm that was consistent, that didn't bend with who is in power in terms of party designation, that had a single standard for fighting corporate power, fighting for the environment, and insisting that peace is a better path than simply enriching the military-industrial complex. So we founded RootsAction.org in 2011. We had about 50 people on our email list. It's now 1.2 million.
Wow.
And we're able to generate about 200 action items per year. And we've developed just a wide array of focuses because we're very multi-issue, although we concentrate especially on issues that we believe are inadequately, to put it mildly, covered by some of the largest progressive online or liberal outfits. And so, for instance, we were lobbying through thousands of emails the Ecuadorian government to give asylum to Julian Assange in their embassy about 10 years ago, then Bradley Manning, before she became Chelsea Manning, was a subject of a petition. We took 100,000 petition signatures to Oslo for Chelsea Manning to get the Nobel Peace Prize. We've been, as I say, very multi-issue. Let me just give you an example, because it's today. We put out an action alert that you can find at rootsaction.org, a petition to the New York Times top editors to actually report when the U.S. ships 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. The Washington Post, you may have seen, broke the story about 10 days ago. And day after day, and I wrote a piece about this that's on Salon and Common Dreams, day after day, nothing in the New York Times, like it didn't happen. So it's become so normalized. 2,000-pound bombs, 1,800 of them being authorized by the White House in the last days, and it's not a story, the normalizing of this kind of military madness. So today's petition is an example. More and more, we enable people with just a touch of the button or two to send an email to their two senators and representative on a wide range of issues. So if you haven't already signed up to get action alerts, I'd suggest you take a minute, go to, there we are on the screen, rootsaction.org. And on the top right, you can simply enter your email address and your zip code, and we'll be connected.
Wow, that's great. We're joined by Marion Eady.
Hey, Marion, hi.
For a while, Marion, you look like you're in the woods. Let me get you unmuted here. There we go.
I just unmuted myself. Well, hello, Norman. Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Harvey, or as I knew him, Sluggo.
How you doing?
Still, you Sluggo anymore?
I'm still Sluggo.
Okay. Anyway, I wanted to go back to something that Norman was saying about the ballots, and I guess also Ruth was saying about the ballots. I want to just say that at the Threshold Foundation, we were funding election integrity organizations that were trying to preserve paper ballots and stop the use of wireless modems, which are so incredibly easy to hack, and so on and so on. And I just wanted to say, I'm going to put my email address in the chat, or maybe Mike, I guess he's the gatekeeper here. If anybody wants to know about the organizations, some of the organizations that have been working on this, like Marilyn Marks out of Georgia with her group, or Susan Greenha, who works with John Boniface at Free Speech for People. And there's some other groups that have been real warriors on this issue. Anybody who wants to know about some of them that we funded at the Threshold Foundation can go ahead and email me, and I will tell you more. I'm going to just put this, my email address.
And I'm going to ask Wendy Letterman, who's putting together our grassroots guide on election organizing, to send you the PDF of where we're at with it. And if you'll take a look and see if it's something the Threshold might be interested in, that would be great.
Unfortunately, Threshold has, they sunsetted their election integrity funding circle, but there are people, individuals that are on it that are very good, who could still, you know, make grants. So there's that path forward.
All right. Well, we'll send you, Wendy will send it to you. We're just kind of holding off on finishing it up so we can get input from other organizations like Roots Action and the Threshold people, so that everybody can have their input before we put it out.
Yeah. And, the other one thing I wanted to say is it true then that Congress has yet to vote on this obscene grant of weapons to Israel, or this money? So does that mean that we should all be contacting our members of the House? Like for me, Jamie Raskin, he ought to be against this.
Absolutely. It is approved by the Senate, but it's not approved by the House. It's all tangled up in other issues like Ukraine. And so it's really up in the air.
Maybe the left and the right can get together and stop it in the House.
Yeah.
I'll make my call.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you, Marion.
Before we go on, Harvey, just want to note,
please,
Marion Edu has been a pioneer in environmental activism, protection, bird dogging, watchdogging, whatever you call it, organizing. And that's going back to the 1970s.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You were a teenager when you started, Marianne. So it's been great to have you all these years.
I wasn't a teenager. I was in my 20s.
Okay. Well, Marianne's been a real hero. It's a true hero in all this. And
I'm getting lost. I'm done.
Okay, I just saw a deer run by you, behind you in the forest there.
Yeah, so.
Okay, thank you. Myla Reason, Myla, let's get you unmuted here. I think you are unmuted.
I just unmuted myself, Harvey, and it's
there
so
you go.
Seeing Norman on with us. And hi, Norman. And I want to ask you, Norman, you've probably noticed, I imagine, that the nuclear power industry, which is intrinsically bound to the weapons industry and the nuclear bomb industry, has been tremendously successful at convincing young people who identify as being on the left. They've managed to convince them that nuclear power is needed to address the climate crisis. And I would say that a good 75% of the young people who I meet who identify as leftists are convinced that we need nuclear power. And as you know, the depleted uranium that comes from enriching the fuel for nuclear power plants is used now in modern warfare. It's used all over. It was exploded all over Iraq and contaminated Iraq for millions of years now, because the half-life of so-called depleted uranium is forever, basically. And I'm just wondering if this is an issue that Roots Action might consider helping us on, because we're really, you know, we're up against a huge PR machine that has been a project for decades now of the nuclear power industry, and they've been tremendously successful.
Absolutely. Great point, Myla. And it's so frustrating and sometimes infuriating to see this spin. Of course, the nuclear industry exploits it every which way they can. Part of it, unfortunately, tends to be, as you allude to, generational. And it just goes to that the corporate establishment, the mass media, they're good at having the amnesia and ignoring history that they don't want, and that puts such a burden on us to, and a necessary one, a good one. We need to keep history alive. We need to prevent the understandings from 30, 40, 20 years ago from just being dropped into a vacuum tube being replaced by people knowing about Beyonce rather than the dangers of nuclear power, just to choose a name out of the hat. As you're saying, in terms of militarism, when I went to Iraq just before the invasion in 2002, I went with the great journalist Reese Ehrlich, who we miss, has passed away. And Reese went on to Basra and southern Iraq, terrible results of the previous use of enriched uranium and so forth. A parallel frustration, but also an opportunity, is about nuclear winter. And Dan Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, goes into some detail about the scientific facts, which have been known and verified for 40 years, about the fact that a nuclear war would be climate change just to an extreme and rapid degree. You're basically talking about the end of agriculture within a year and an estimated 98 to 99% of the planet in terms of human beings no longer being able to survive. And, you know, without naming names, I've had dialogue with a couple of the most famous climate movement leaders who don't want to touch nuclear winter issues. They don't want to touch nuclear issues. As a matter of fact, one said publicly, and then I had a dialogue about it, that the nuclear weapons dangers had been solved, basically, and that we needed a similar movement about climate. And so this is an ongoing educational organizing challenge that we face.
Right. And you're also probably aware that now the Biden administration at the last climate summit managed to convince, I believe, 22 other nations to join with them in calling for increasing nuclear power as a way of combating our climate crisis. And here in the United States, Governor Newsom has abrogated a really important historic deal to shut the decrepit Diablo nuclear power plant in Northern California. And Gretchen Whitmer is now championing bringing back to life a zombie nuclear power plant, Palisades, and throwing $8 billion at it in order to reopen a nuclear power plant that is now closed and is just one of the most dangerous ideas imaginable, because that plant is really ready to explode should it be reopened. So,
This is a horrible and important example of how somebody in leadership doesn't even know that we almost lost Detroit. Maybe we got to send her a copy of the book. This is like, let's forget that history even matters. Let's expunge all of the events of the past that are not convenient.
It is mind-boggling. We're approaching 4 o'clock California time, 7 Eastern. We still have 49 people. One thing about our calls, Norman, is our people have really long attention spans. It's really great. A lot of these people have been on for more than 2 hours with us. But it's really great to have Norman Solomon with us. Tatanka, let's go back, then Wendy, then Donald. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because you went off the screen just when I came on. But I made a suggestion that actually coming up to Daniel Ellsberg Week in June, and then during that week that you might consider us using this show to have people call in to really get reports from around the country, because this is really important. I mean, we have the potential to do our part in making this the next step to a movement, a national movement of nonviolence against nuclear weapons.
Yes, I'm glad Norman brought that up about nonviolence, because, you know, we conducted the entire Clamshell Alliance in the mid-1970s. We did 4 major civil disobedience actions at the Seabrook nuclear plant, and no one was harmed. The anti-nuclear movement, in many ways, might be the first hugely disciplined nonviolent campaign. We were trained by Quakers at Seabrook. We had nonviolence training where people, you know, role played, and first as cops and then as demonstrators and so on. And Norman, you've been one of the pioneers in that. It's been a remarkably disciplined campaign to get rid of nuclear power and weapons in this country.
Well, this is a quick other jaunt down memory lane. after the first clamshell Seabrook actions, we were inspired in Portland, Oregon, and throughout the state and Northwest to organize to, for the first time, nonviolently blockade an operating nuclear power plant, the Trojan plant up on the Columbia River, about 40 miles away. Harvey, I remember you came and spoke. We then organized. We had three blockades there, what we called occupations, 82 arrests, 123 arrests, then over a four-day period, 280 arrests. We filled the jails in seven counties, and eventually the Trojan plant was shut down. But as you're saying, it's an example of the power of discipline, nonviolence. It's obviously, or should be obviously, the opposite of passivity. You know, the cliche is that it's a passive activity to be nonviolent, when actually we know to make it change history, it's the opposite of passive.
It's amazing. I mean, the demonstrations at Seabrook, the big ones, concluded in June of 1978, where we made a deal with the state, which was controversial, as you might guess. But the Attorney General of the state of New Hampshire approached us and said, if you will agree to leave, what a thing to ask. If you will agree to leave, we will let you on the site at Seabrook. And 20,000 people showed up. And Pete Seeger sang, and Jackson Browne, and John Hall. And it was an incredible weekend. And then everybody left. It was mind-boggling. And we wound up shutting one of the two nuclear plants at Seabrook, so which was a major accomplishment. So there you go. It's amazing how the nuclear issue has gone hand in hand with nonviolence, of which we learned the hard way from Dr. King and Gandhi and Nelson Mandela. And in our case, we were trained by a woman named Elizabeth Boardman from the American Friends, and Suki Rice from the American Friends Service Committee in Boston. And, you know, that was the school for nonviolence, which all these years later, it's 50 years since Seabrook. And we're still in a nonviolent frame of mind. It's fantastic. Norman, you've been a big part of it. Let me go to Mike Hirsch, who hasn't spoken yet. Mike, go ahead.
I just wanted to say it was great seeing my good friend, Marion Eady, my neighbor. And it's always wonderful to hear from her. She launched the League of Conservation Voters. Okay. And unfortunately, after she left, they kind of lost their way. But that's nothing to do to her. She did a great job setting them up, and she's been terrific, and I'm glad to call her my friend. And you were mentioning the Clamshell Alliance. Did you guys know Richard Bell at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was
Dick Bell.
Yeah, he's one of my good friends. He dropped the name Dick after Dick Cheney became prominent. He refused to be called Dick anymore. It was strictly Richard. But yeah, it was wonderful. And what you guys accomplished with the Clamshell Alliance, just amazing and inspirational. And I'd like to maybe do a deep dive on how successful that was at some point moving forward. I think we can learn a lot from that.
Well, it was an amazing experience, the Clamshell Alliance. And Norman, I remember visiting you in Portland back then. And, you know, Trojan is gone. It's, yeah. There's an amazing statistic. There have been about 250 atomic reactors ordered in the United States. About 130 were actually built. And only a half of those have not experienced an outage of more than a year. And so now we're down to 94. And we have passed, you know, I've mentioned on this call, we have passed a major landmark. Since the Vogtle plant in Georgia went online in the last few weeks, which we're not happy about. But nonetheless, in the United States today, since 1954, is the first time there are zero large atomic reactors under construction and zero on order. And all these people talking about a renaissance of nuclear power are out of their minds. No one's going to build a big reactor in this country. And this whole thing about the small reactors, it's just a pipe dream. They're not going to work. So here we are. We have a vacuum for the first time since Shippingport, when the Navy and Westinghouse combined to build this reactor outside of Pittsburgh. For the first time in 70 years, there are no large commercial reactors under construction or on order in the United States. It's an enormous tribute to nonviolence, as we say. and to activism.
Slugar, I just wanted to say real quick, great to see you again, Norman, as well.
Oh,
I miss
likewise.
You. And we did a lot of great things with PDA. So it's always good to see you. Great to hear from you, as always.
So, Norman, we're at the top of the hour. We normally go to 4:20 California time. If you want to stick with us, that's when Wendy goes out and tokes up. if you like, we'll go another 20 minutes more. Happy to have you stay with us. Speaking of which, Wendy, you've got your hand up.
Thank you. Finally. Thanks. I do have a question for Norm that I'll try to quickly work my way around to, because I have a couple of points. One, quickly to your point there, Sluggo, about the new reactors. You know, I've been really concerned about what I've been seeing lately is all the money that was allocated in the infrastructure package that, like, there's 200 new applications where they, you know, because the tech industries want to power their servers. So they're starting to use existing plants to keep those open, and then they want to try to build SMRs on the.
Wendy, you should probably kill your video. There you go.
Okay. Thank you. So there's so much to make money for the military to be using the DE from, like, if you go over the military budgets, it shows that the Biden administration is basically calling on the Department of Energy and has basically quotas of minimum amounts of the highly enriched uranium, depleted uranium, to supply from the Department of Energy to supply the Department of Defense. And this goes to the space-based program. This goes to everything. So, I mean, it's basically like they're going to, I see it as they're going to try to do everything they can to create this supply. And one thing that we're not talking about, and I'm going to be as quick as I can with this, but, you know, we kind of mentioned that this would be a little bit about the lack of, and we did touch on it, the lack of journalism covering the quote unquote war, which Palestine doesn't have an army. So I don't know how we call it that. But the war in Gaza right now, one of the only ways that information is getting out is through eSIM cards that I'm going to put a link in the chat to that people can donate so that they can supply cards for people in Gaza that they basically hook up their devices to solar panels. And that's how the reports from on the ground are getting out. And that's the only way we're seeing this. What we're not hearing is that we are basically in World War III right now. What's happening with Russia, China, Iran, the way we're attacking Yemen. I mean, they're all these places. And like you said, you know, you're talking about mutual assurance where everyone's got like standing in the pool of gasoline with their matches. Like, to me, I see it as like we're caught, like we all have the flu and we just keep coughing on each other. So, Norman, that's what I'm wondering, like your stance right now when, I mean, we're in World War III. There's no way around to say that we're not, and we're just not calling it that. And where do we go, like, as activists and people to, like, draw us back from the edge that we don't even see ourselves walking off of? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, facing the realities is very, very grim picture. When we look at this year, which inevitably, given which it is a election year, we have a circumstance where there are two militarists running from the Democratic and Republican parties, and one essentially fascist at this point running on the Republican ticket. And so those are realities. The domestic policies are very different between Biden and Trump and what they represent. The foreign policy, they're both unhinged. And the particular style of militarism that is just so extreme, which is way worse than I think I or others expected from Biden, it's very categorical. I mean, you think of somebody like Biden, and we want, you also think of, say, Antony Blinken. Back in 2002, the gavel of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was held by Biden, and the chief of staff was Antony Blinken, and they held important hearings in the middle of summer, basically to help greenlight the invasion of Iraq. When Trump was in office, Antony Blinken was at West End execs who were basically brokers, lobbyist brokers for arms manufacturers and dealers. They're not defense contractors. I in the book, War Made Invisible, I go out of my way to say we need to clean up our language. This is not defense spending. Yes, there's something uppercase defense department, but the spending is not defense spending, it's military spending. So we would want to hope that because of evolution and of individual changes and social pressures, people could change. But in fact, Blinken and Biden and so forth, they are on a equivalent of a corporate American-based jihad. They believe in, or at least some of their advisors believe, that regime change in Russia is possible, as has been pointed out by Jeffrey Sachs. Before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there was virtually no diplomacy worthy of the name by the Biden administration whatsoever. We can remember shortly before the invasion, Biden was asked at a news conference, what do you think about the prospects of Ukraine joining NATO? And he said, essentially, well, if they want to do it, why not? He could have said, no, we need neutrality there up against the Russian border. We have models of Finland and Austria and elsewhere. Neutrality can be a good thing. But instead, he basically de facto green-lighted the invasion. So I could go on and on, but as I think we could say quite accurately, the U.S. is engaged in two hot wars and one cold one. The very lucrative Ukraine war, just a boondoggle for the weapons manufacturers. The slaughter in Gaza, which is by most definitions genocide, being bankrolled by the U.S. government. And then the colder war against China. China, I don't think, has been in a war in 40 years. How many wars has the United States been in 40 years? Just to give one example, we hear so much in the media, look at what China's doing in the South China Sea. They've got all their ships in the South China Sea. And when was the last time you heard a TV anchor point out what the middle name of the South China Sea is? The middle name of the South China Sea. So it's, hey, we get to have, it's not only a Monroe Doctrine, forget that. It's not just this hemisphere. Now we're supposed to be able to run as much of the other hemisphere as possible.
Mind-boggling. Thank you for that, Norman. Very well stated. Donald Smith, and if you want to get your hand out, we're gonna disperse at 4:20. So if you want to get a word in, time to put up your hand. Norman, you've been very, very gracious. We still have 46 people with us. Donald Smith, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to follow up on something that Norman mentioned just briefly. And he said that when he presented he mentioned Daniel Ellsberg's name to the congressional staff, they said, who's he? Well, something that I've noticed is, and I go to meetings of my congressmen and other congressmen, and all the staff members are like in their early 20s. Now, I have nothing against young people, but why don't they have like older, and perhaps some of the senior staff are older, but it seems like all of the staff I've interacted with are very, very young. And maybe this is, and also when I talk to Adam Smith, my member of Congress, he doesn't know about all sorts of things that you know, I've invited people to explain things to him. He doesn't know about it. And maybe this is all because Newt Gingrich defunded the congressional research staff. And so I think this is actually a big scandal that the Congress doesn't, often they don't know what's going on. They're dependent on lobbyists or somebody to tell them what the truth is. Like, they don't know what happened in Ukraine. They're just believing what the CIA is telling them.
Well, Adam Smith is a great example. You know, in the War Made Invisible book, I talk about Adam Smith in particular, who, as you know, Donald, was the chair of the House Armed Services Committee until the Republicans took over. And in his cycle before this last one, he got $400,000 from military contracting companies. So he's somebody who is a great example in many respects, because a couple of cycles ago, he had a somewhat credible challenger, not a hugely funded one, but one who could make him sweat a little bit. And his position on ICBMs began to change. And he began to make at least, if not a lot of sense, at least less insane comments about ICBMs. But there was no credible threat last time, and he has just reverted to his same militarism now as the ranking member.
Right. One of the things, Norman, I want to note here, and very well stated, is that we very strongly advocate that money in going into the election from progressives go to grassroots organizing and not media stuff. And I saw, you know, a TV ad from Summer Lee, who we, of course we many of us are, and we're nonpartisan, by the way, on these calls, we're C3, but we like Summer Lee, or at least I do. But they, you know, she took she produced the TV ad, which doesn't seem like a decent ad, but you know, we have had the great gurus of grassroots organizing, Andrea Miller and Ray McClendon. I don't know if you know them.
Andrea, yeah, she's great.
So, you know, we are really pushing, especially this year, in the idea that all progressive money needs to go to grassroots organizing and not media, not so much a media campaign. I guess you buy an ad or two, but, you know, come on, this is where it's at. This is the big shift. Okay, we're nearing the end. Again, if you want to say one thing to Norman, now raise your hand. Steve Caruso in Ohio. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, Greg Coleridge was going to try to introduce this film. Jenny Spanos just put it, the link and the title of it.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to play it. It's Creative Commons. Norman, were you familiar with that? They were
Sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you a bit. Could you speak a little louder?
We've had Greg Coleridge from Move to Amend, who has, you know, fighting the Citizens United decision. And he's in Cleveland, and he's been with us on a lot of calls. I guess he has a new film. Do you have the link to the film, Steve, that you could put it in the chat?
Yeah, we've done that. I can play it, but if you want to...
No, we can't. That's one of the, you know, we are on the radio, Norman, and so we don't really play many videos. Uh-huh. I'm sure it's a good one, and everybody should take a look at the link for Greg Coleridge's latest. Greg's a really good guy, and they Move to Amend is a great organization. So keep up with that. Wendy, go ahead, and then Paul.
Thank you. I kind of wanted to tie the first hour with this hour. I know you came in a little bit before you started speaking, Norm. So in case at all the work that you're doing is interested in what we were talking about with just the general election oversight, with making sure we have independent audits and tools to make sure that everybody can know that their vote is counted regardless of partisan, so we can get away from the partisanism and move beyond. My friend Paul Burke is still here on the call. He has votewell.net. He's an amazing resource. He's brilliant. Works with Ray Lutz with Audit Engine as well. I work with both of them. So I can be in touch. I put my email in the chat. We also do work with Assange Defense and Vinny DiStefano. He's the lead organizer for Assange Defense here. I really appreciate you mentioning Julian there. So I'll reach out to send you the guidebook. Yeah, we're all, our hearts are with Julian. And I want to mention it's the 5-year anniversary of his solitary confinement at Belmarsh when he was forced to leave Ecuador because of the regime there. I'll be in touch about the guidebook. But if you're interested in some of the election work, maybe get in touch with Paul, who's here, and I'll be in touch with you. So thank you so much. Thanks for all your input here today.
Okay. Thank you, Wendy. And I'm glad to also hear from folks at norman@rootsaction.org.
Great. So we will be forwarding you the PDF of the book in its current form, and hopefully we can collaborate on it. Paul Newman, Norman Paul is in LA. He's got solar panels on his roof, and he was the star of The Sting, which I think you saw many years ago. No, that's not him. Sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
I got blue eyes. No. But anyway, Norman, you said something that was very interesting. Now, here is my take about Ukraine. They had the Orange Revolution against, Yergoshenko, who was the president, was a puppet under Putin. They wanted to get to be a member of the EU, which is what I understand. I heard this Ukrainian friend of mine named your Ukrainian friend, Sasha, who's on TikTok. And he said that they also wanted to join NATO. Now, I never heard anything about them wanting to join NATO. But now my take on this, I'm just framing this, but my bottom line is this. I believe that our military industrial complex is slowly giving them arms. They need arms now. They're going to run out. And when Russia comes in, it's going to be a nightmare. And the theory is, like the domino theory, that Putin's going to go for Moldova, and he even said it, and he's going to go also for Poland. So What were you alluding to when you talked about Ukraine and the military-industrial complex?
Well, I'm alluding to, for one thing, it's a tremendous cash cow for weapons manufacturers in the United States, but tremendously lucrative. They're very happy about it. Also, if you look at principles of nonviolence and diplomacy, you also look through the window of the office of your opponent, not just through your own window. So imagine if the Warsaw Pact built an alliance with Canada or with Mexico, what do we think the response would be from the United States? There has been a real potential to recognize that not just Putin, but across the political spectrum in Russia, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, earlier than that, from the right wingers and the monarchists, all the way to the democratic activists in Russia, all of them opposed to Ukraine joining NATO. You look at the map, you see the huge border, you can see why. And yet the arrogance from NATO and from the United States saying, well, that's tough. We're going to keep that option open anyway. So that's completely wrong. And the solution is diplomacy. When we hear, oh, it's going to get really bad, it's already been bad. For 2 years, it's been slaughter. It's been slaughter of Ukrainians. It's been slaughter of Russians. So why do we reason that it would be a bad thing to engage in actual diplomacy? I think that's a key question. And one other point, there's been a lot of posturing from politicians in the United States. We're so moral. We're so brave. We're so virtuous. Let's you and them keep fighting. You Ukrainians, you just keep fighting and killing those Russians, and they'll keep fighting you. And we are so virtuous that we're going to keep sending you all the weapons you want. I don't think that's a solution at all.
Well, the only thing is Putin has pretty much demonstrated that he would even call for ceasefires and things like that, and then not honor them.
Well, I mean, the United States has demonstrated it's willing to kill a million people in Iraq. It's willing to slaughter civilians in Afghanistan. If you look at the cost of war project data at Brown University, you find that 4.5 million people have died because of the so-called war on terror. Where is the high ground from the United States? I'm not saying that the U.S. hypocrisy justifies the crime of Russian invasion of Ukraine, which was a crime. But on the other hand, the Russian invasion of Ukraine doesn't justify U.S. foreign policy, which sets the pace for aggression and mass murder.
Being NATO, right? I mean, according to you, that's NATO.
According
to you guys.
What's NATO?
Pardon?
I'm not sure what you're saying.
No. In other words, the aggression is the fact that Ukraine wants to join NATO is related to the United States aggression.
I'm
is that
saying
what you're referring
that to open the possibility for Ukraine to join NATO was and is a prescription for war that will slaughter vast numbers of people. And it should never have been an option. It should never be an option. Just as a Russian alliance with Canada or Mexico should not be an option in terms of military coalition.
Right. Go
ahead, Paul. We're almost out of time.
Okay, real quickly. I have heard that the Russians, historically, there's just been a mass history of the Russians doing horrible things in Ukraine. From the 1933 Holodomor, which is a massive starvation, where they used collective farms in Russia that didn't work. And as a result, they went to Ukraine to get their food, and then they starved millions of Ukrainians. I mean, there has always been this history. Ukrainians believe that they're fighting for their freedom to have their own country, their own sovereignty. And they're a European modern nation too. So, I mean, it's a very difficult situation we're in. And I don't like the arms manufacturers posturing of this because they seem to be looking at this strictly as money-making. And I don't like that. On another hand, I'm very scared of Putin because I think he's off his rocker. And so that's my position.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I appreciate that. And I certainly think we should condemn the Russian invasion, Russian war on Ukraine. No question. One key question is, how do we stop this war? And I think just funneling weapons into Ukraine and continuing to treat diplomacy as a dirty word is just exactly the wrong way to go. And I just close on this note. before the midterm election, you may remember about 25 members of the Progressive Caucus in the House sent a letter to the White House calling for diplomacy. And you may remember it was as though they had thrown a hot stove at people. And within a couple of days, under tremendous pressure, they withdrew the letter and they retracted the letter. What kind of country treats diplomacy and advocacy of diplomacy as something horrific that we should always deny we even favor?
Mm-hmm. Good point, boy. Very, very good. And Norman, you are just a master at this. And you should let Jeff and Jeff Cohen and David Swanson know that they're also welcome anytime. We really think Roots Action is the best thing since sliced bread. So there you go. We're going to give Wendy and Tatanka a chance to say goodbye, and then we're going to let you go. It's been phenomenal. You've been with us well over an hour, and a beautiful presentation. Wendy, go ahead and Tatanka, please.
Thank you. And you know, Paul Newman, you know, I always respect your input and your opinions on things, and always on this, I'm going to diverge just a little bit, or actually I'm going to come in on the side with it. There was actually a peace agreement that Zelensky had agreed to months before even Nord Stream and things happened, and NATO and America came in, and the next day the peace agreement was done. That was like in March, I think, of a couple of years ago. Mainly, I mean, Putin's been going in for the part of Ukraine that is Russian speaking, and a lot of the people there are essentially Russian, and they feel a connection to Russia. It once was Russia until fairly recently. So I think at this point, after 2 years, after what, 100,000 people being killed, we would have seen Putin, if he wanted to go in and take over Ukraine or other parts of Europe, he would have done it by now. And why are we the ones supporting Ukraine with all of this money? If if the European countries are so afraid of them, then why aren't they on the front lines? Why aren't they sacrificing their tax dollars? And I'll just say one quick tactic that it's a small thing that goes along with like boycotting. But one thing that we can do as individuals that I've been thinking about, that we can take our own money away from the war machine, is if you donate to 501c3s like GREEP or other tax deductible organizations throughout the year, then you can deduct those taxes. And it's basically a way of you taking control of the way that you would want your taxes to be spent, as opposed to killing babies all over the freaking planet.
Very clever, Wendy. That's a real cute backdoor. Of course, we can also just donate to Roots Action as well. Tatanka, you get the last word, and then Norman will let you say goodbye. Tatanka, you're still muted.
Okay, I've got it now. You asked a question, Norman, what kind of government turns down the diplomacy, speaking about our government? It's a kind of government, and I people have heard this from me. I was attempted to be recruited out of Stanford Research Institute 48 years ago in the fall. After the November election of 1976, my task was to head up the Ukraine team to, quote, bring democracy to the Soviet republics. They told me that there will be no Soviet Union in 15 years. Now, I knew it was a CIA-supported institution. I knew I wouldn't take the job, but I wanted to find out as much as I could. So I said, tell me more. I'm interested. I asked for their 50-year plan. They went through the whole thing. They said sometime shortly after 2020, we will very likely be at war with the president of Russia. This is what I was being offered, nearly $200,000 a year per diem, et cetera, to head up. And I asked, why would we be doing that? And they talked about, well, you know, NATO, our, quote, defensive ally, they will be surrounded, that all that move. They said to go after our real enemy. I said, you mean China? I said, yes, we don't want to fight a two-pronged war. Russia belongs with Europe, so we can focus on our enemy. It was an investment, the form of, quote, diplomacy that our country, our war-making country, does, a 50-year investment in that war. So they're not about to back down on something they've been planning for 50 years. It started 2 years before I was there in 1974.
Okay.
So we need to follow the money. We need to understand the history. We need to understand that the elite including our U.S. government, makes 50 and 100-year plans. And we need to have people on the inside willing to talk about it and write about it so we can educate ourselves. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tatanka. Thank you, Wendy. I think that's a lot of Roots Action does. Norman, you want to take us out? Been great to have you.
Really, really quickly, you know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy gave a speech at American University, and he was sobered after 8 months of that crisis. And he said, we must never put ourselves in a position where we back a nuclear adversary into the corner, where they see either the survival of their own power or capitulation. And this is that whole lesson from John F. Kennedy, from John Kennedy, is in the dumpster at the White House. That whole concept that you don't back your nuclear adversary into the corner and give them either capitulation or they go down. There is a regime change hope among many in the Biden administration and, of course, among Republicans as well. And I'll just close on this note. Dan Ellsberg talked about at the RAND Corporation, of course, working for the Air Force, he and some of his colleagues went to the movies when Dr. Strangelove came out. Right. And when they left the theater, they said to each other, that was a documentary.
Yeah. There you go. Hey, thank you so much, Norman. It's been fantastic. Do join our YouTube channel. Mike just put the link in there. Support Roots Action. You're welcome to come back anytime, Norman.
Really, thanks, everybody.
Great time. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week. Not the week after, but we will see you next week with Roger Rappaport on energy, especially in Michigan, and then a whole session on EMF and electromagnetic frequencies. You guys are all great. Wonderful to have you with us. Still more than 40 people. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Thank you, Norman. Si se puede.
No nukes, everybody. Thanks. See you in
Salt. All the money.
No nukes.
No nukes.
No nukes.
May this eclipse bless everybody with balance and alignment in their lives and good vibes.
There you go.
Positivity, good ions.